Okay, as you can see on the screen behind me, we're still in 2 Samuel, but this will be the last Sunday, Lord willing, that you see that. Next week, we plan on going into Genesis, so pray for that study. That's going to be a long one. But nonetheless, we are here in 2 Samuel, and this is the last chapter in this book of 2 Samuel. If you remember when it was originally written, it's possibly all one big book, 1 and 2 Samuel. And the last four chapters have been what Todd or some of the commentators refer to as an appendix. So it's kind of really hard to really go back and get a good background as to what we're getting into in chapter 24 because we're not really exactly sure when it took place in the book of 2 Samuel. But nonetheless, the whole book of 2 Samuel has been pretty much about the reign of David. You know, God's been at the centerpiece of everything, but David ascending to the throne in Hebron, reigning there for 7 years. David becoming king over all of Israel for the remainder of his life. You know, he had the ups and downs. He had good times, and he had good moments, and he had moments that he probably wished he could forget. But nonetheless, he's a man, a good man, a man after God's own heart, but he's still just a man. So as we get to chapter 24 of 2 Samuel, I'll read verses 1 through 9, and then we'll kind of jump into it. Again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he incited David against him, saying, "Go number Israel and Judah." So the king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, "Go through all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba, and number the people, that I may know the number of the people." But Joab said to the king, "May the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of the Lord the king still see it. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing?" But the king's word prevailed against Joab and the commanders of the army. So Joab and the commanders of the army went out from the presence of the king to number the people of Israel. They crossed the Jordan and began in Aroer, and then from the city that is in the middle of the valley toward Gad and on to Jazer. Then they came to Gilead and to Kadesh in the land of the Hittites. And they came to Dan, and from Dan they went around to Sidon, and they came to the fortress of Tyre, and to all the cities of the Hivites and the Canaanites, and they went into the Negeb of Judah at Beersheba. So that when they had gone through all the land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. And Joab gave the sum of the numbering of the people to the king in Israel. They were 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000. Now, there's a lot to unpack in this or to untangle, and there's some things on here we're just not going to be certain about. But we might as well get started, right? So it starts off at the very beginning, again, the anger of the Lord was kindled. Now, this again could be a reference to the previous famine mentioned in chapter 21. You remember in chapter 21, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and there was a famine for 3 years. And that was over the Gibeonites. You know, there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. The Lord was angry with the nation of Israel for the bloodshed that they brought upon the Gibeonites, whom Israel had sworn an oath to back in Joshua 9. You know, they kind of broke that oath and actually tried to slaughter the Gibeonites. You know, that's where they come to him and they ask for the sons of Saul, and David gives them the 7 sons of Saul. So God judges them by bringing 3 years of famine upon them back in chapters 21. And now, again, the Lord is angry. We are being reminded that this isn't the first time the anger of the Lord has broken out against Israel. This isn't the first time. Now, we're not told exactly why the anger of the Lord is kindled. We're just told it was. You know, we can speculate as to why, and that's what I did, but we can't know for sure why he was angry. You know, Del Ralph Davis says, if we are upset over a text that tells us the Lord is angry but does not tell us why, are we not saying that we don't trust him to be just? If the Lord is angry, we can have confidence that he is right and he is just in his anger. And do we actually assume that God owes us an explanation? I think sometimes we get that. You know, the anger of the Lord had broke out, and we're not really told why. there are some people who speculate that it could be over their treatment of David when they followed Absalom, you know, and actually sought David's life, and how they treated David again with Sheba. Some people think that's why the anger of the Lord had broke out against them at this point, but we're not told, and again, we're not necessarily owed an explanation. The Lord is right, and he's angry with the nation of Israel. And it says his anger is a kindled against them, and he incited David against them, go number Israel and Judah. Now, some translations have the word he capitalized, and that implies that it's God who incites David to number the people. You know, it was he incited David against them, saying, now we are told pretty much in, you know, certain terms that the numbering of this people was a sin. Joab, and actually in 1 Chronicles 21, Joab's going to cause it a cause for guilt. Why would you bring this guilt upon Israel? That's what he's asking David. You know, when you see in verse 10, you know, we read all the way through 9, but when you get to verse 10, it says, David's heart struck him after he numbered the people, and he said, I've sinned greatly in what I've done. So it was something in this numbering of the people that was sinful. And again, Joab even started pushing back against it, causing it a cause for guilt. And it said that the thing that David did, the numbering of the people, displeased God. So it was a sin. But God, was God the one who incited David? You know, this doesn't really seem to square, because James 1 tells us that God tempts no man. God could not tempt nor incite David. He could not do this. So if you would open up to 1 Chronicles 21. Kind of, if you want to, you can kind of keep your ribbon on one of these two places. We may refer to this off and on. 1 Chronicles 21, just a few books over. Now, 1 Chronicles 21, this is talking about the exact same event. Verse 1. Then Satan stood against Israel and incited David to number Israel. Interesting, isn't it? So here we learn that it was Satan, not the Lord, that moved David to do this. So that capital probably shouldn't be in over in 2 Samuel. But you see, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people of Israel. And he sovereignly allowed Satan to tempt or incite David. He sovereignly allowed this. You know, sometimes God allows us to pursue sin, not because he delights in it, just rather somehow these sinful decisions will become part of his greater plan and bring him glory. Only God can work all that out, but he does. God is angry. David sinned greatly by numbering the people. God is displeased, and God judges David and Israel. So, let's jump back in 2 Samuel. Like I said, leave your ribbon over in 1 Chronicles. So what was wrong with numbering the people? Again, a lot of these things we're just kind of not sure on. But why number them? You know, some will insist that David was preparing to defend Israel from a threat or a neighboring nation. You know, trying to justify his motives. But Joab doesn't seem to be interested in justifying his motives when he's trying to talk David out of doing it. And plus, this census took 8 months. No, I'm sorry, it took 10 months. In verse 8, it says it took 9 months and 20 days. So this doesn't seem to happen at a fast enough pace to justify a defense. You know, like David doesn't appear to feel like he was any kind of imminent danger. You know, every other time we see David acting this quickly. You know, he had that one military advisor, Amasa, and he says, you know, go and gather an army. You got 3 days to do it. Here he's looking for 10 months to count the people. I don't think that this has anything to do with a defense. David's kind of preparing a defense. I don't think that at all. And like I said, you see Joab is reluctant, and he seems to insist that the number of the people is wrong. A cause for guilt is what he calls it in 1 Chronicles. But you see, in 1 Chronicles 21, verse 2, he says, why do you delight in this thing? Why do you want to know this thing, David? And David says, go and count the people that I may know their number. David wanted to know their number. It seems that this guilt or this sin of counting this people was pride. Joab sees the root of this sin in David, and I believe it's pride. You know, in verse 4, we read that Joab was trying to stop David from pursuing this temptation. And as he's trying to stop him, you know, David's going to overpower, basically, Joab. And look what it says. Joab and the commanders of the army. So it seems to insist that the commanders of the army were on Joab's side trying to, you know, hold David back from pursuing this sinful census. But David wanted to see the numbers, and he overpowered them. He wanted to see the numbers. He wanted to see the might of his military, where all along it had been the Lord who had won the battles for Israel. All along it had been the Lord, but David suddenly wants to see the numbers and wants to see the might of his military. So by counting the men, David was not counting on God. You know, it's funny, if you think back to 1 Samuel, in the very beginning of 1 Samuel, you have Israel desiring to have a king when it was God who was their king. It was God who was their king, but they wanted a king like the other nations who would go out before them and fight their battles for them. They had basically wanted to place their confidence in man. And here, at the end of 2 Samuel, we see David doing the very same thing. We've come full circle. David's trusting in the size of his army. But again, be careful, be cautious before you cast stones at David. Because I think this kind of is a sin we deal with a lot more often than we think. You know, I know it's easy to think, and everybody's probably got a different number. If I just had $5,000 in the bank, I'd be secure. Or 10 or 20. I don't know what your number is, but there's a number probably you have in your bank. If you just had that, you would be secure. And that's really what David's doing. If I had this million-man army, we'd have some security. When all along it was God. All along it's been God. And even in our life, all along it's been God who's always provided for us. I mean, we get and we work, but it was God who gives us the power to do these things. But it's something in us that just thinks, if I just had this, I wouldn't need that as much. But it's just the way we are. So when that happens, what or who are you trusting in? Now, I guess I'll jump into a discrepancy between these two texts. In verse 8, it says there's 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah, they were 500,000. If we were to read 1 Chronicles, when the numbers come back, it's 1.1 million plus 400,000. Now, the most simple explanation for that is that David tells them to go and count the people basically who are military age, who are able to carry a sword. And so Joab counts the men of military age available for military service. Now, we're also told in Chronicles that David had a 288,000-man army. That was a standing army that was with him month in, month out, day in, day out. So we can round to 300,000. And so maybe 1 Chronicles, maybe 1 Chronicles is counting David's standing army along with the ones that are available for service. The 800 plus the 300 make the 1.1. I don't know. I'm just saying if you ever run across that discrepancy, that may be a good explanation. But just to recap this first 9 verses, God is angry with the people of Israel, and God allowed Satan to tempt David. In my opinion, this temptation was pride and self-reliance. But nonetheless, God allowed Satan to incite David to number Israel. David was even discouraged from doing so by Joab and his commanders of his army. But he overruled them. He prevailed against them. And when the numbers came in, David's heart was pricked and he realized that he had sinned greatly. And that's when we get on into verses 10. I'll read 10 and 11. But David's heart struck him after he had numbered the people. And David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I've done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly. And when David arose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer, saying. So the Gad is sent to David. So David was convicted of his sin before the prophet came. We see that. He was convicted of his sin as soon as the numbers came in. And then the Lord sends Gad. And if you remember when we were going over the sin of David and Bathsheba, David and Uriah, he says in one of the Psalms that the Lord's hand was heavy upon me and my bones ached. You know, you just saw that the Spirit, the Lord was convicting him of his sin in David and Bathsheba. David was convicted of that sin before Nathan came to him. You know, the Spirit was convicting David. I think you see the Spirit convicting David here. Now, sometimes we don't heed to or we try to ignore the chastening hand of God, and God sends someone to point out our sin. You know, we saw that with Nathan. But here, David seems to respond to this conviction from the Spirit, and he repents in verse 10 before Gad gets there. You know, his heart has struck him after a number of people, and he starts, I've sinned greatly. Oh, Lord, please take away my iniquity because I've done very foolishly. So he seems to have repented about this. And then God sends Gad. And I say God sends Gad, which is clear at the end of verse 13. Gad is speaking. He said, and decide what answer I shall return to him who sent me. So, without question, the Lord sent Gad to David to deliver this message. But if you're like me and you just ask a ton of questions, why did the Lord send Gad? Why did he not send Nathan? You know, Nathan was the one who went to David and rebuked David and exposed his sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. That was Nathan who done that. Why did he not send Nathan? Why did he send Gad? Again, I don't know, but we can only speculate, and here's a thought. Nathan was not with David when David was hiding from Saul. Now, when David was on the run from King Saul, and he was hiding in that cave of Adullam, Nathan wasn't with him. But you know who was with David? Gad. Gad was with him. So, I mean, I guess I probably could have narrowed that one down for you. But anyway, that old trusted friend of David, who was with David when many were seeking his life. You know, Gad could have looked to David and said, David, when you were on the run from Saul, and you were few in number, yet God was on your side and you trusted in him. David, why now that you've been set as king over God's people, have you began to trust in numbers? See, Gad could look at him and say this because Gad was with him in those dark days. Do you not remember, and we're told in 2 Samuel 7, that the Lord told David, David, I've been with you wherever you went. God was with David wherever he went. David didn't need an army of a million men. He just needed God. And Gad could say that, David, God's been with you the whole time. You know, like when you're falling away and then all of a sudden the Lord sends somebody into your life that brings you back to that place in your life when you solely trusted in God. And that's what Gad is, that man for David. I was with you, David, when it was very few of us. We were outnumbered greatly, but God was with you. God delivered you. You don't need this million-man army, David. You just need God. So Gad runs into David's life here. And in verse 12, he's fixing to give him the word of the Lord. Go and say to David, thus says the Lord, three things I offer you. Choose one of them that I may do it to you. So Gad came to David and told him and said to him, shall 3 years of famine come to you in your land, or shall you flee 3 months before your foes while they pursue you, or shall there be 3 days of pestilence in your land? Now consider and decide what I shall return to him who sent me. David said to Gad, I am in great distress. Let us fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercy is great. But let me fall not into the hand of man. The Lord's going to offer three judgments. 3 years of famine. Now, I know the King James, or the New King James, actually has 7 years of famine there. Again, the Septuagint has three. Most translations have three. First Chronicles 21 says three. So I'm not really sure where the seven came from, if it was just a scribal error. I'm not sure. But three seems to fit. Like, you get three options, David. Three offers of judgment. 3 years of famine, 3 months of fleeing, 3 months of pestilence. Those are your three options, David. Choose one. Now, the 3 years of famine would more greatly impact the poor of the land. You know, the king and his household would most likely survive a 3 year famine. You know, they had the resources that the poor of the land didn't have. And they had already survived a 3 year famine back in chapter 21. So we know that. We know the 3 months of fleeing would also provide the king, David, with some level of protection. He was their king. But David just simply puts his trust in the mercy of God. He seems to place everything in the hand of God here, knowing that God is more merciful than man. You know, I'm in great distress. Let us fall into the hand of God, because His mercy is great. The mercy of God is greater than that of man. And David just knew. David trusted in that mercy of God. It's just amazing me of how much faith he had in some of these attributes, as we call, of God. But David seemed to know that the hand that would strike him would also spare him. The chastening hand of God would spare him. And so David chooses to fall into the hand of God. And then we get to verses 15 through 17. So the Lord sent a pestilence on Israel, the latter of the three options, from morning until the appointed time, and there died of the people from Dan to Beersheba 70,000 men. And when the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented from the calamity and said to the angel who was working destruction among the people, "It is enough. Now stay your hand." And the angel of the Lord was standing by the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. Then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking the people and said, "Behold, I have sinned and I have done wickedly. But these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and against my father's house." So these numbers, the census that David began this whole episode, these numbers that David had placed his trust in, his confidence in, they're about to be drastically reduced. And we're told that the plague went out upon Israel from Dan to Beersheba. That's from the north to the south. And they did so from the morning until the appointed time. Now, most people think from the morning refers to the morning to which Gad came. So Gad comes to David, gives him three options. We have the choice with the three choices. We see David's response, and the plague went out that morning, right then. And it says he did so until the appointed time. The plague went out from morning till the appointed time. And I admit, when I first read some commentators' view on this, I thought, what are they fussing about? The appointed time is the 3 days. That's the appointed time. But that really doesn't make sense, because it's not the 3 days. If it had been the 3 days, then how can it be say that God relented from the disaster? You know, so it can't be the 3 days. The appointed time, some people speculate, it could be the appointed time of the daily sacrifice. You know, they offered sacrifices every day in Israel. And that was the time of the appointed time. But I don't know. The plague went out that morning, and it was going to move right through Jerusalem. And the Lord said, "No, that's enough." And it seems the angel stopped midstream. Now, David saw the angel who was striking the people. You see that in verse 17. When he saw the angel who was striking the people, David saw this angel. You know, 1 Chronicles 21, it says David and the elders seemed to see this angel and fall on their faces. In 1 Chronicles 21, verse 20, it says Araunah the Jebusite saw the angel, and his four sons saw the angel. And when they saw the angels, they ran and hid themselves. So there's several people that see this destroying angel, and I believe they're allowed to see this angel as evidence or proof that this was no natural plague. This was from the hand of God. So we see David here choosing the mercy of God in verse 14. It was God's mercy in verse 16 that spared. You know, they provoked the Lord, they angered the Lord, and the Lord judges them and punishes them, but he does so with a merciful hand, and he says, enough. It is enough. That's what he said in verse 16. It is enough. You know, the Lord shows mercy with this stiff-necked, rebellious people. But when it came to his son, he showed no mercy. You know, I just couldn't wrap my mind around that, you know. How Jesus took the unrelenting wrath of God. You know, these people deserve. You see, several times when these judgments of God go out, God's always merciful, and that's enough. He went far enough. But never once did he say that when they were at the treatment of his son. But nonetheless, it pleased the Father to crush him, and so that's why he took the unrelenting wrath of God. We're here. This wrath swept through in probably just a matter of hours and killed 70,000 people, and God said, that's enough. David sees him, and then we move on in verse 18. David sees him, and he tries to intercede for the people, by the way. He's trying to intercede. So verse 18, and Gad came that day to David and said to him, go up, raise an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. So David went up at Gad's word as the Lord commanded. And when Araunah looked down, he saw the king and his servants coming on toward him. And Araunah went out and paid homage to the king with his face to the ground. And Araunah said, why has my lord the king come to his servant? David said, to buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be averted from the people. Then Araunah said to David, let my lord the king take and offer up what seems good to him. Here are the oxen for the burnt offering, and here are the threshing sledges and the yokes of the oxen for the wood. All this, O king, Araunah gives to the king. And Araunah said to the king, may the Lord your God accept you. But the king said to Araunah, no, but I will buy it from you for a price. I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God that cost me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. And David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So the Lord responded to the plea for the land, and the plague was averted from Israel. End of chapter. So the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite is located just northeast of Jerusalem. And we know from 2 Chronicles chapter 3, you don't have to turn there, that it was Solomon. It says, Solomon began to build the house of the Lord, that is the temple, in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to David his father, at the place that David had appointed, on the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. So this site that David's fixing to buy from Araunah the Jebusite was the very piece of land that they used to build the temple on in Solomon's day. Do you know anything else that might have happened on Mount Moriah? On this very place. On this very place. Genesis 22, for what it's worth. For Genesis 22 is the very mountain where Abraham took his son Isaac. You know, to offer him there to the Lord. And then the Lord is going to provide a ram caught in a thicket. So there's a lot that took place on this little parcel of land. But nonetheless, you know, Araunah is going to offer the oxen. He's going to offer the wood. He says, you know, you can have the yoke of this oxen for the wood for the burnt offering. And here's my oxen. But there's something to a sacrifice that's supposed to be sacrificial. So David didn't want to necessarily give to him. You know, and again, David may be looking at many suffered as a result of this plague. You know, naturally, they suffered for their own sins. That's what verse 1 is talking about in verse 1 of chapter 24. It was the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. David's numbering the people was really just a trigger that poured the judgment of God out on these people. But they suffered for their own sins. but that many people suffered as a result of this plague. And David felt the burden of this sin. You know, he had probably felt as though this judgment came upon the people by his doing. I think that's what he's saying back in verse 10. You know, it was David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. Please take away the iniquity of your servant. Verse 17. He says, behold, I have sinned. I have done wickedly. You know, if we were to turn to 1 Chronicles 21, verse 17, David said to God, was it not I who numbered the people? Was it not I who gave the command to number the people? Is it not I who sinned and done this great evil? But these sheep, what have they done? You see, David probably felt the burden of this sin squarely on his shoulders. Although they were guilty of their own sin. But you see, he says, let the burden of this fall on me and my house. You know, let this fall on me and in my father's house. You know, and as great of a man as David was, he was not an acceptable sacrifice. He was not an acceptable substitute. As great of a man as David was, he was not an acceptable substitute for the wrath that was being poured out on the people. But there is one greater than David, Jesus, who will be able to absorb the wrath of God. There was a difference. David couldn't do it. David offered, but David couldn't do it. Jesus did it, accomplished that very thing. But you see, David may have looked at this as, I caused this, and they, 70,000, paid the price. And now that David must offer a burnt offering, will someone else again pay the price? Maybe that's what David's running through his mind. You know, I think David's heart's in the right place. His heart is definitely in the right place. But if you would turn to Malachi chapter 1. Fixing to wind this thing down. Malachi chapter 1. We look at Malachi chapter 1. I'll just start easing into verse 6 and start reading. It says, a son honors his father, and a servant his master. If then I am your father, where is my honor? This is the Lord speaking. If I'm your master, where is my fear, says the Lord of hosts to you? O priest, you despise my name. But you say, how we despise your name? By offering polluted food upon my altar. But how we have polluted you? By saying that the Lord's table may be despised. When you offer blind animals and sacrifice, is that not evil? When you offer those that are lame and sick, is that not evil? Present that to your governor. Will he accept you or will he show you favor? So basically, they were offering the blind, the lame, something that was no good for anything else, the leftovers. That's what they were giving God. That's what the people of Malachi's day were giving God. He's like, hey, just give it to your governor and see how he likes it. You know, giving God your leftovers. You know, sometimes I fear that we even do that ourselves. You know, it's just easy to give the leftovers. You know, you're laying in bed and there's nothing left to watch on TV, so I guess I might as well read my Bible. You know, it's the last 10 minutes of the day, the last 20 minutes of the day is when you just give God what's left over. He never gets first place, or he doesn't get what he deserves from us. I've heard people, well, I'll serve God when I get older. It's basically saying the best years of my life when I'm young, why would I want to waste them serving the Lord? I'll use the latter years of my life when I'm not that useful. And I don't mean that toward old people. But you know, that's it. I've heard that. I know you've heard it too. You know, why serve the Lord when you're young? Why give them your leftovers? Give them something. It's just not the way it should be. He deserves first place. He is first place. Now, they had such a low regard for God in Malachi's day. You know, you actually see in verse 13 of Malachi, if you're still there. Look what he says. But you say, what weariness is this? You know, it was so weary. They were just weary of serving God. All we do, this is just so weary. Just because they had such low regard for him. And David didn't have a low regard for God at all. David wasn't going to give God the blame, the leftovers, the freebies. David was going to buy it. David was denying himself to give to the Lord. Now, in saying that, there's another ditch we could jump into. Get out of that ditch, get into another ditch, right? We tend to do that, and it's amazing how many times Jeremiah is coming to mind now that we've been going through it on Wednesday nights. But in Jeremiah 6, the people there, we went over this last Wednesday, the people there were actually going out and buying expensive oils and expensive fragrances and thinking somehow this made their worship more acceptable to God. Somehow this made their worship more sacred, more holy. But their heart was far from God. You know, believing that out of your abundance of your sacrifice, you're somehow winning favor with God or somehow buying favor. Well, that's the other side of it. It's all about where your focus is. You know, when your focus is giving God your leftovers, your focus is really on you. I want what's good for me. I want to take all I want first and I give you what's left. That's your focus when you're giving God the leftovers. Your focus in Jeremiah's day is you're putting all your faith and focus in that gift or those fragrances, you know, as if somehow that's going to save you. Your focus never ends up being on Christ and Jesus, the Messiah, the Christ. But, you know, these expensive oil, these expensive ways we want to worship doesn't make our worship any more sacred, any more holy. It doesn't. The only way your worship is pleasing to God is through His Son. Everything else is just ceremony. You know, your worship isn't more pleasing to God standing up here wearing a suit and tie. It's not. It's not. Your worship isn't more pleasing to God singing hymns over spiritual songs or spiritual songs over hymns. Your worship isn't more acceptable reading out of a certain version or translation, I should say. You know, everything has got to point to Christ. Everything's got to point to Jesus. From our Sunday school, it should be pointing to Jesus. From our preaching, should be pointing to Jesus. From our singing, should be pointing to Jesus. Our baptism points to Jesus. The Lord's Supper points to Jesus. Our mission work points to Jesus. Anything we do, when it's not got Him at the center of it and the point of it, we're probably wrong. But nonetheless, we see David did this very thing. He bought this land from Araunah. He offered these sacrifices, and the plague was averted from Israel. End of book. So we see this happened here. We don't know how much when this happened. We think it's toward the end of David's life. Nonetheless, he lived out his life as a king and did much preparation, including the purchase of this land, getting ready for his son Solomon to build the temple that he had the desire for way back in chapter 6. So, Lord willing, I hope we can glean many things from this book as we move forward, and pray that our study in Genesis beginning next week will again be worthy and God-centered. So if you would please stand. Blake, would you please close us out, sir?